What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of the Chat It Up podcast. As always, I'm your host, Shooter, bringing you interviews, news, and reviews about all things Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Speaking of news, just saw the press conference with Governor Whitmer. Sounds like we're opening up parts of the UP starting here on Friday. 50% capacity at bars and restaurants and a few other types of places will be open. Sounds like we're still going to have some guidelines. But definitely breaking news. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out heading into Memorial Day weekend. But hopefully everybody still practices social distancing and is wearing their masks and doing what they can to prevent outbreaks from spreading now that we're kind of loosening up these restrictions. But definitely a good step in the right direction. I hope everything goes smoothly. So other than that, we'll jump right into things here. Have a really great episode. So we'll start things off as we always do with This Day in Upper History. And that's brought to you by the good folks at pasty.com. That's PASTY.com and the Pasty Central Facebook page. So here is May 21st, This Day in Upper History.
Pasty Central Day in History, May 21st. On this day in 1937, a contemporary song entitled My Michigan was named an official state song by the legislature. However, the words and melody of that composition has been all but forgotten over the years in favor of the more popular lyrics from the Civil War era set to the tune of O Tannenbaum. Home of my heart, I sing of thee, Michigan, my Michigan. Thy lake-bound shores I long to see, Michigan, my Michigan. From Saginaw's tall whispering pines to Lake Superior's farthest mines, fair in the light of memory shines, Michigan, my Michigan. Pasty Central Day in History, May 21st.
All right, another big thank you to the folks at Pasty.com and the Pasty Central Facebook page for making that segment possible. It's time for this week's interview, and it is with Miss Beth Milner. Beth is the owner of Beth Milner Jewelry in downtown Marquette. And not long after the quarantine hit, I saw a news story about Beth and her small business and what she had been doing to not only keep her business going, but what she's been doing to help our community, and by community I mean the UP at large, and also to help our frontline workers and our healthcare workers. So I reached out to her, and as you'll hear from the interview, what she was up to was quite the monumental task, and she was so wrapped up on that that it took us a while to be able to finally sit down and talk. But once we were able to kind of make our schedules align, I'm so glad that we did. Not only to get her backstory and really get to know her better and what she's all about and her awesome small business here in the UP, but also to just hear a great feel-good story. I sound like a broken record, but you look at the media and there's so much doom and gloom and bad stuff going on, and this is the exact opposite of that. This is just a really great feel-good story. So other than that, I'll get out of my own way here. So without further ado, let's chat it up. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I am here with Miss Beth Milner. Beth, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so we'll just kind of hop right into our interview here. So are you originally from the UP?
I grew up in Marinette, Wisconsin, which is on the border of the UP, so I probably spent half of my time in Menominee, which is in Michigan, so
right.
I'm like an honorary Uper, I think.
Yeah, I was just about to say, you know, being from Marinette, that almost kind of makes you like Uper by association just because you're so close there.
I'd like to think so. I mean, I'm sure it's debatable.
Right. Well, and, you know, me being from Iron Mountain, I kind of view a lot of places that are right across the Wisconsin border to us kind of the same. There's like Niagara, Wisconsin, Aurora, Wisconsin, so, you know, Spread Eagle, Florence. Those are all like super close. So I kind of just associate that with the UP as well. So that's
the same land and the same water, right?
Right.
So as most people know listening to this, you're a jewelry designer and creator. And I know a lot of people, like, when you're growing up, you like to make like friendship bracelets, or when I was a kid, like hemp necklaces were the big thing. I don't know if that like ages me at all.
No, but I did that too.
So was working with like jewelry when you were a kid and doing those kinds of things, was that something that you did as a kid, or was like working with jewelry something you found later in life?
No, I've always worked with jewelry. So the first memory of making jewelry was when I was in elementary school and we went to a rummage sale and there was a bag of friendship bracelets that were knotted. And I thought, I want to make those. And they were from that DMC floss that's used for counted cross stitch, like crafts of the 90s.
Yes.
And so my grandma had some of that and so did my mom. And I started doing friendship bracelets, and I did that, and I got into beads. I did hemp necklaces. This is a funny one. For a period there, it was like popular in my town to pierce your fingernails. So if you had long fingernails, you would like make this little charm for your fingernail, which is just weird to me now, but it was a thing. I've always made jewelry, and I dabbled in glass bead making, and I didn't really do any metalsmithing till a little bit in high school, and then I really dove into it in college.
Okay. So speaking of college, you ended up going to Northern. Was that just kind of like the natural choice, or was there something that really kind of led you up here to Marquette?
I had only come up here once. I had some friends that lived up here that had moved from my hometown, and I came to visit and I said, I'm going to move there forever. Like it was kind of everything that every other little UP town wanted to be, but it had like cool things going on. There was people on bikes and things I wasn't seeing in my hometown, which is, you know, it just felt like there was a lot of culture or the culture that matches me. There's culture everywhere, but it felt like it was more me. And it was so beautiful. Like you never really realize how the terrain is so incredibly different here than most other places in, especially in Wisconsin. It's very flat, you know, unless you get down south in Wisconsin or by the, you know, over into different areas. So it was the beauty. And then the friends, that it was really just the place and the friends, you know, that was my main reason to come. And it wasn't super far from home.
Sure. Sure. That makes total sense. So obviously you studied jewelry, and you just mentioned like metalsmithing. Can you walk me through like what goes into, I guess, metalsmithing? I'm picturing in my head, like a blacksmith, like pounding iron with a big hammer, but I know I'm probably just being naive. There's probably more that goes into it than that.
Well, you know, what's interesting is all the metalsmithing crafts sort of overlap. And so I did actually take blacksmithing in college. And mm-hmm. So I pounded on the metal. It was difficult and hot and messy. But with the jewelry making, there's a lot of different steps. But most of my work, we use a jeweler's saw, which for people who have some hand tools, it looks like a coping saw with a smaller blade. And so we do a lot of little tiny drill holes and intricate pierce work in the metal. But we do hammer the metal. You don't have to swing nearly as hard or heavy as you do with steel, but we do hammer the metal for texture, but we don't work on it while it's hot. So it's cool when we're doing that. We do quite a few different things. I mean, we do some things with wire, we do soldering. And so that's where you use the torch and flux and a little piece of solder, which is a metal that melts at a slightly lower temperature. And you heat that with the torch to close seams. And then we also do lost wax casting, which we can start with an original carved wax. And you put that inside of a can of plaster, essentially. And I'm using kind of more common terms rather than bogging us down with jewelry terms. But yeah, you put this in a can of plaster, and then you melt the wax out that's in there after the plaster hardens. And then you inject molten metal where the wax was. And so we use that process for some production techniques and a lot of the jewelry, and we kind of do a whole lot of things. We do stone setting. I actually pick up rocks from the shoreline of Lake Superior and we cut those and put them into jewelry too. And that's a more recent sort of thing that I've gotten into.
Very cool. And that's super interesting, because I feel like the majority of just the general public wouldn't realize how much of that goes into actually like creating jewelry. I mean, when you see like an item, you don't really think of all of those minute like processes that really go into it. So I find that super interesting.
Yeah, the most time consuming part of the process, honestly, is finishing the edges of metal and the surfaces. Because if you get a scratch on there, then you might have to go through three grits of sanding tools to like get it back to a nice surface, and then polishing if you're going really shiny. And so that part of it is more than half the time is actually making it look nice. So it's once you get good with the skills, it's pretty easy to, well, easy, it's relative, you know, after 15 years or so of doing it, but it's pretty easy to cut out a shape. But then the time that it takes to actually make that feel nice and wear nice and not be snaggy and looking just kind of like it's hacked out. That's the part that actually takes a lot of the time. My full-time assistant, Nina, really does a lot of the production work. I definitely have and do still make a lot of jewelry, but she really does a lot of the production for me.
Sure. So as you were going through school, I'm just making the assumption that that's really kind of as you like find your personal style and craft along the way. Does that come from studying other people's style and techniques, or is that just something you kind of find on your own? I mean, how does that kind of really come about?
That's a good question. You know, when I was in college, I really wanted to make pieces that were inspired by the natural surroundings. And I was really kind of, I am still an environmentalist. And so I was making these silhouetted shapes where you'd see the piece of metal and you'd see a tree. But what actually was going on is the tree wasn't there. You're seeing everything that surrounds the tree or the bird or the animal. And I've since spun off of that idea, but I was thinking about back then, like how all of those things are what allow the tree to exist is what's around it. And so it was sort of a little bit of a statement on what could happen if we're not good to the environment, but also embodying the beauty of the area that we're in. And so that's kind of what I was thinking about when I was in college, when I started doing these silhouetted shapes. And then it sort of spun off from a simple silhouette of a tree to all the different ways that I use a tree or a bird or a symbol in the jewelry. And so it's sometimes, you know, some artists design, they might make the design and then decide what it's about. Some people might decide what they want it to be about and then make something to follow. But I would say it kind of just depends. I go both ways on that. But yeah.
I love that because it's very unique to you, but also very unique to the UP. I mean, you hit on a couple of things, you know, eco-friendly. You're using local sources, right? You're pulling stuff from just right here in the UP, correct?
Yeah, I use recycled silver, which doesn't necessarily come from here, but it is recycled. And then I have UP copper that I bought a stash from a guy when the first few months of opening my shop, and he told me that his dad worked at the White Pine Mine, and I got that copper. And it, you know, for jewelry that's relatively small, it was like several probably 4 foot sheets by 6 inches. And so it'll run out eventually. And I doubt I'll be able to get more sheet metal. People oftentimes will offer me chunks of raw copper, but it's really not that easy to take that and turn that into sheet metal. It would just hike the price up so far sure. that I'd worry about being able to sell it or make people happy.
So you graduated in 2008. How did things really start off for you then with this after you graduated? Can you kind of walk me through that process?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I actually started while I was still in school. So the so I started kind of in 2007. There's some spots online that say 2008 because it's kind of relative when you're in school, you know. Mm-hmm. I started online with an Etsy shop when nobody knew what Etsy was, and it was all handmade. And there's a lot of there's still a lot of good stuff, but it's flooded with a lot of mass-produced things, I believe. And so I started with Etsy, and I remember going into the classroom and telling my teacher, I made $45. I sold that piece of jewelry. He's like, $45, you know, and on the internet. And he's like not the type to even email. So he was just, you know, it was pretty funny. I decided when I was still in school, I was working at the Sweetwater Cafe, which was awesome restaurant, and they were really environmentally friendly, but I just wasn't content waiting tables anymore. I'd done it since I was 15. I was ready to kind of move on, and I decided, you know, I'm just going to take the leap. And so I quit, gave them notice, and that was, I think, March of 2007. And I started the Etsy shop and started selling jewelry. And, you know, if I sell a piece of jewelry that I was going to make anyway for $45, $50 compared to working in a restaurant and making $45, $50 in tips, I thought it was just a perfect solution there. And so I did art fairs that first summer. I went to like Hiawatha Music Festival and Bliss Fest and maybe the Outback Art Fair, I think, and probably the Iron Mountain Art Show. I remember doing that one before. I think it was a long time ago now. But yeah, so I did like 4 or 5 art shows, and I thought I was rich. I think I made like a few $1,000 that summer, and I really thought I had like made it, which is good because it, you know, it was about the same as what I would have done waitressing. So
that's very cool. And probably in some ways, a cooler, unique way to kind of see the UP. You know, if you're going to travel around and hit some different festivals, it probably gives you a little bit of a different perspective on some of the places around the UP, I would think.
Yeah, you know, I love music festivals, but I fell in love with them by doing shows. And some of them were in Lower Michigan, but I didn't really go past the northern part of Lower Michigan, maybe once, and the show didn't go very well for me. So I kind of stuck closer to the area. I would do there's two shows, I think they still happen. Yeah, I'm pretty certain they do. Well, this year might be weird, but in the Keweenaw Peninsula, there's two art fairs, one in Copper Harbor and one in Eagle Harbor as well. So I would do those. And yeah, I've kind of got to visit all those places. And at the festivals and things, it was, you know, I was on a shoestring budget. I started with like $1,000 of student loan money, and that's it for everything that I started with. And so I didn't have money. I had to borrow like money to get a car when I was about to graduate, because I like a $900 car, you know? Sure. but yeah, so I traveled around, and I kind of lost my train of thought there, but it was really awesome to get to know the UP through doing art fairs.
Very cool. Was your plan always to like build this up enough to open a shop in Marquette, or as you kind of, you know, made more money and kind of picked up that momentum, then did it kind of become the plan, or how did that kind of unfold?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. You know, my significant other, Mike, helped me in the beginning. We lived in a little tiny cabin right after graduating off the grid up by Big Bay. And I ran an extension cord through the woods to get a little bit of solar power off this other cabin that the owners would use seasonally. And I would try and upload like 10 listings at once on Etsy, because the internet was so slow. It was like this thing you'd plug in dial up speed. Yeah, it's funny. I forgot your question. I was just mentioning before you started recording that I didn't sleep because I was listing masks. So I'm a little,
That's totally okay. My question was just if it was always the plan to open a shop in Marquette, or did it just kind of evolve into that as you kind of made more money and the business grew?
Yeah, the plan was not to open a shop. You know, when I was doing the art fairs, I really, really enjoyed it at first. But then I started to get a little tired of the setup teardown, dealing with the weather. Or like a show I did, all the wind took my booth a little bit when at night, and all of my glass broke, and it was all in the grass, and I had to deal with it. And you know, like that stuff's not the end of the world, but like that. When you have an actual location, you don't have to set up and tear down every day, and you don't have to worry about the weather blowing your booth over. And so what happened was I was working from home, and my significant other, Mike, had helped me. And then I had hired a friend to help me like once every other week for a few hours, just tagging the jewelry, putting tags on. And I started to realize that I was moving slower than the customers would like on orders, and I could potentially employ someone. And so I started thinking, I kind of want to be out of my house. You know, I didn't want to do the home and work thing, which funny enough, I'm enjoying that a lot right now. but I just thought I got to switch this up. And so I started looking for a place to rent, and the place I bought downtown Marquette, the food co-op was not across the street, but it's right across from the Marquette food co-op. And I saw it was for rent, and then all of a sudden the sign changed for sale. And I had a couple friends tell me, you can buy it. I was like, no, I can't buy a building downtown. That's absolutely crazy. How would I ever? And so I didn't have enough of a down payment to buy the building for a typical commercial loan, but I actually worked with Northern Initiatives, who does, I kind of like to describe it as they do financing when the bank almost could have. And they actually helped me with the down payment, and not all of it, but part of it. And then the bank lent me the rest. And so I was able to buy a building. It had three apartments in it when I first took it over. And now I've taken over the whole space except for one apartment down in the basement, a studio apartment. So
that's awesome. And I'm glad that you brought up Northern Initiatives, because I know that they've been instrumental or extremely helpful for a lot of people in your shoes, you know, or in similar situations to you, in the surrounding area. So, just an awesome kind of pull back the curtain of showing people what really goes into being a small business and what it takes sometimes to really make things work.
Yeah, definitely. Northern Initiatives was Really great. I actually served on the board for 5 years. So they invited me to be on their board of like 18 people. And I learned so much about business financing and what goes into it. And some people think, oh, they're a bank, but they're not really a bank. They are a community service lender. And so there's some really great people behind that organization. And they've recently expanded to service, I think, all of Lower Michigan and part into Wisconsin a little bit too.
Very cool. So when you purchase this building, you're starting off, there's maybe you and you can hire one other person. Now today, I mean, prior to making the masks, which we'll obviously get into, but you had prior to all this, like 6 or 7 employees, correct?
Yeah, I think it was up to 9, 8 or 9 actually at one point. So it kind of fluctuates a little bit, you know, through the pandemic. That's been a hard thing to say, oh, how many people do I have? Because there are some people maybe not ready to come back to work, or some people I don't have the total hours that they used to, but you know, we have had everybody working at some point during this pandemic. Yeah. And so I've got some really long-term employees that I have been really great. So Jana has been my shop manager for 6 years, and Nina, my studio assistant, has been with me for 5 years. And I've got Lex, the assistant manager, and they're going on, they'll be 4 years this summer. So it's those people that really have, they're all amazing, but to have some people that stuck around for a long time allowed it to grow to where it's gotten.
Sure. And I'm guessing, I mean, you've mentioned kind of the technology piece a couple of different times in our conversation, but I'm guessing as the Etsy's and the internet of the world has continued to, you know, to kind of grow, I'm guessing that probably helps a lot, or is a lot of what you do online commerce?
Now it is.
Now it is. Prior to all of this, I guess then my question is, prior to the quarantine, was a lot of what you were doing online, or was it just?
It was mostly in the store, actually, except for certain times. Like when we did a sale, we'd find that online would be better. But I believe that most people were looking at our website before they came in. Okay. So even though they maybe didn't pull the trigger online, they would be coming in knowing what they wanted. And sure. So we're so fortunate to have that e-commerce and have a really big website that we've worked very hard on. Yeah. Over the years, especially when now it's kind of been like, oh, everybody's got to switch to online, and we were lucky to be able to pivot quick.
Sure. And I'm thinking too, probably with jewelry, a lot of it is like tactile. People want to hold it and see it and maybe try it on before they actually buy it. So I guess I could kind of see where you would probably maybe have more walk-in traffic than buying stuff online.
Yeah, at certain times of the year it was 50-50, but I would say only maybe 25% or less was online at varying times of the year. It'll be interesting to look back at the data after this year, because people are still very much supporting us, and they are figuring out how to do it online if they haven't before. We take a lot of phone orders and stuff too for people who aren't comfortable ordering online.
Sure. Well, speaking of this year and this whole COVID situation, I know it hasn't been easy for small businesses like you guys. What sort of challenges have you had to deal with since all of this kind of hit?
Yeah, you know, in the beginning, just like everybody, I was afraid of what was going to happen to people with their health and what would happen to all of the businesses. You know, it's like, oh, I almost get emotional thinking about it, because I'm friends with most business owners in town that have small businesses. And so, you know, pretty much everybody laid their staff off because, you know, the revenue just dropped like really immediately for everyone. I was able to keep mine for a bit longer than everybody else, but then I realized, I don't know if I should do this because I was just kind of paying and there wasn't orders really coming in, you know, and we were all struggling to kind of pivot and work from home. I had got the nose pieces, which we'll talk about with the mask stuff, I'm sure, kind of out, and they were helping with that, and we put out a mask pattern. But then I just thought, oh, it's so stressful for all of us. And I had bigger worries. Like, do you guys have enough food in your fridge? Like, have you stocked up for several weeks? And I just couldn't make them sell jewelry. It didn't feel right at the time. So I laid everybody off, which was the hardest thing I've ever done, but it was probably a relief for all of us because it was frantic working and we're all stressed and trying to do it, but it just wasn't right at the time. We needed a minute to kind of reposition and kind of figure out what to do with the business. And so, you know, that stuff is incredibly hard, but I'm not the only one who did. I think most people laid off their staff. So,
yeah, that's like you said, that's got to be extremely tough. I can't imagine having to make that decision. Cause like you said, I mean, there's the human element to it. Like, do you have food in your fridge? I mean, there's bigger things at play than just making jewelry and a job.
Selling jewelry when a pandemic hits feels like the most trivial thing you can do. Like, honestly, it's not important at the beginning of this. It's important that people take care of their family, themselves, they're safe, they have what they need. And that to me was like the biggest thing we were talking about when we were trying to kind of work was, do you have what you need? You know, and I really care about my staff. I have like the best team I've ever had. I mean, that always happens. Like, it always gets better. But I needed to let them have some time. It wasn't just to save on the bottom line. It was just almost impossible for all of us to like function properly. And when we were changing the entire business, trying to get remote, we were working really hard to get these nose pieces out for free, like really hard. We shipped out, I'd say like 30,000 free nose pieces for these masks, with help from the Superior Health Foundation on the shipping. And so, you know, we usually ship a couple packages a day, and me and my partner, Mike, were shipping like maybe 100 a day and making the packages out of Tyvek for siding, because shipping wasn't going to be quick enough for more mailers. And, you know, we're like, okay, Ace will do curbside pickup. Let's get some tape, you know? And so we got tape. So I only managed to have my staff laid off for like 2 weeks, and then I needed my manager back, but her daughter's at home, right? So this whole thing's complicated, and her husband was still working, but working from home. And so you know, you try to navigate this with respect, and it's sort of this leveling, like I'm not their boss. I need them to voice what they need or want. I'm not the boss with some top down idea here. We got to figure this thing out together. And what do you need? Are you safe? Do you have what you need? You know? And that's where I came from. Cause I really care about people. Like, that mattered more than business at that point.
Yeah. I love that. I mean, you know, obviously a lot of these small businesses have had to shut down, and, you know, very thankfully you were able to pivot and not only just from a business standpoint, but to be able to help people and to help a lot of people. So let's continue to kind of talk about this. So these nose pieces are the pieces, is that sourced locally? Are you getting that from another business? Or I guess what other sort of local businesses have you been working with on this stuff?
Gosh, so many, and I'm bound to forget some, but I will try and mention them all. You know, I haven't really done an in-depth interview about this at all. It's just been kind of a little bit of a surface thing. But, you know, so what happened in the beginning is I was part of a mask group on the internet, and I saw that they're making metal nose pieces with hand shears, just cutting them out one by one. And I thought, oh no, that's going to take forever for the need that we're looking at, if they're requiring everybody to wear a mask, or they're hinting at it, and all the hospitals are needing them. And I saw that there was mask groups all over the UP. And I could, you know, you kind of feel this buzz on Facebook about it. And I thought, no, we got to make these faster. So my partner, Mike, actually got his roofing tools out and made a couple thousand in, you know, a couple hours maybe. And I was sanding all the edges of them at that point, because I thought, oh, we got to sand all these edges. And that kind of, I don't know if that's necessary exactly. But yeah, we gave away those couple thousand. I barely even remember who. I think we donated them to the local mask group, and they redistributed. Actually, I think we gave them to Alley Cats, the quilt shop I'm buying all my fabric from, and they distributed them. And I didn't even know them, except for I knew that their business was a couple blocks down. And then, you know, we quickly realized that there was no way we were going to make what the demand probably was. So we called Dan Perkins, and Dan Perkins started making them, and he gave us 20,000 to distribute. And, we distributed all of those, and then he gave us more. And so we distributed, I can't remember exactly, I could look it up, but I think it was 36,000 nose pieces in the UP. And then it turns out, you know, I had a potential contract from a big sewing manufacturer in the UP to supply the nose pieces, but they were also contacting Dan at the same time. Him and I both realized it, and I sent them a video, and I was like, you guys, that just make it work. Like, I don't care if you get it from him or from me, get these masks out. Like, it, and I didn't care. Like, money became irrelevant to taking care of people, especially when how scary it was in the beginning. We really didn't know how contagious it was. It was on surfaces. So we were baking all of these nose pieces in the oven. We had a health protocol from the UP health system about how to bake them for sanitizing. And so Dan Perkins got that big order from the clothing manufacturer, and he turned around and donated all that money back into nose pieces, and he donated 100,000 of them.
Wow.
I even had Terry Deering with Quick Trophy involved for a minute, drop shipping. But I think I burnt myself out in that phase, and it was just complicated. So I like stopped for a minute, but I had Adam from Upper Hand Window made nose pieces, and I was going to try and distribute them and come up with a model, but I was struggling. It was just a bit much. And so he donated them to the mass group, and I think he had a few thousand. And then I know that the window store, we had contacted them and they were donating to the mass groups too. And so I don't know what the total is there, but it's, you know, not to sound egotistical, but somewhere deep down, I'm like, did we just actually flatten the curve over the past few months here? Like, it just hits me like, I don't care if it was us or not. I'm just glad that it's doing good right now here, that we're pretty safe. But
yeah,
so the nose piece thing was bonkers. We worked so hard at that, like really, really hard. I had one of my employees look up all the mass groups all over the whole UP, and they were just getting started. You know, there's a group here that really was kind of keeping that ball going, but she got a hold of all those groups and put them in our project management software. And then I reached out to all the admins because I knew the shipping costs would be too much for the Superior Health Foundation to keep sending 5 packs, 25 packs around. So I sent their admins 1,000 of these, and they redistributed. And so that worked really well to kind of get them out without burdening the health foundation too much with the cost of shipping too.
So you mentioned kind of like looking big picture. Have you really had a chance to like stop and take a breath and really like
think
about the gravity of this? I mean, I'm listening to you, you know, explain this, and I just keep thinking, wow, like it's overwhelming in a good way. I don't know if it makes you emotional, but it makes me emotional. It tugs at your heartstrings. I mean, what you guys are doing is just incredible.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, when you know you have the skills to do something and you know the people that can make it happen, there's no excuse to not when people's lives are in the balance. I kind of immediately thought Rosie the Riveter, you know, and that's, I felt like I'm in the military from my spare bedroom. This is so weird. but we just worked, you know, I haven't had a day off since this started. Like there's people in hospitals taking care of folks day in, day out, and people struggling and suffering. Like I can work for a while. Like, and that's kind of how I felt the whole time. It's like when I get too tired or I'm exhausted or can't think, I actually sew for a little while. And that's kind of how I operate in my jewelry studio. If I can do some production work or just kind of do something creative, then I actually get my thoughts back, or I take a nap. You know? but yeah, the gravity of it, I think looking back will be pretty interesting. I think in 20 years, what are they going to look at here with what we've done in our community? Wow. And you know, maybe COVID wasn't really here anyway, but maybe we stopped it. I don't know. Maybe
yeah.
Stop it. Slowed it. Maybe we slowed it.
it's wild to think about, but you know, when you mentioned sewing, I mean, let's talk kind of about then because you kind of went in depth about the nose pieces and such and getting those distributed. With these masks that you're also producing, one of the incredible things is that you've actually been able to add some employees, right? Over and above what you had working at the shop, right?
Yeah. And I will admit that the payroll protection loan that can turn into a grant is definitely making that decision easier. But I was buying masks outright before I ever got that loan from folks. Sure. And so that's kind of an interesting thing. If you spend it in a certain amount of time on payroll, it can be forgiven. And so it gave me some confidence to kind of do this. But yeah, I've hired 10 people. One of them's full-time, all the rest are part-time. And then I have my staff. So like with me, that makes actually 20 people in a pandemic. I have more employees than I've ever had by a lot. And I've given some of these people their first job. Some of them have never sewn before. So one of my friends, Wendy, her son, he's 16, and they had to come back up here. It's kind of a long story, but he's a gymnast, and you know, everything got canceled, and she was living downstate with him to enable his gymnastics. He did a flip for us on Zoom the other day, just on it's awesome. And I've known them since he was a little tiny boy. When I lived off the grid in the cabin, they lived by us, and he'd come up and he'd can I hammer on metal? And now he's like 16, and he's kind of running errands for us and delivering masks and things between the different people, because everybody's working from home that's doing this. So so I hired those people, and I have a couple of people I bought masks outright, and they actually are really productive. So I have several people I've bought from, to like 4 different people that aren't even on my payroll, that have made a lot of masks. I have two seamstresses on my payroll right now. It's temporary, I believe, you know, but maybe not for all of them. Maybe I have a sewing company at the end of this too, and we make something else.
Yeah, I mean, you've got your sewing machine right there over your shoulder. I mean,
this was lent by the Makers Lab at the Marquette Senior High School, actually. And So they lent me this because it's in their Makers Lab and it's been used once. And I messaged her yesterday. I was like, I'll buy it. It's like, tell me, I don't want to hold on to this too long. And she's like, it's fine. If you're using it, use it and get it back later or buy it later. I'm not worried about it. Like, because no one's using it there at all. So it's actually way nicer than the sewing machine I have in the other room that I had to send in for a repair. That I haven't fired up yet because this one's so nice. Yeah. I'm thinking of other volunteers, you know, for the few minutes I had Quick Trophy doing drop shipping, Household Appliance donated an oven for him to sanitize in. And so when we decided maybe let's not do that, we messaged Household Appliance back and they said, oh, can we donate that to a family in need then? And it was GE that donated the stove. So, you know, it wasn't out of their pocket. My accountant, Mary Lutonen, she's helped me so many hours, like endless, making sure I'm not making the wrong decision on pricing or how I'm kind of taking care of this. Oh gosh, there's so many more people. I'm definitely missing some. They've all been super supportive.
It's just incredible to see really an entire community band together to make this possible. I mean, it's special stuff. So with your masks, let's just talk about the masks a little bit more because, you know, if you look out there, like you said, there's mask groups everywhere selling these things and a lot of them, there's different styles and different things. So yours are both adjustable and washable, right? You can basically reuse them.
Yeah, I was kind of a fly on the wall with all the conversation in these mask groups as I'd just be sort of aimlessly scrolling Facebook and I'd see complaints or people getting masks. The elastic hurts my ears. Oh, this one doesn't fit. Oh, I need it. This doesn't have a filter pocket. Oh, it's hot or whatever it might be. And so I started internalizing all that feedback people had out there. And we started sort of thinking outside the box. So we are doing masks with ties. I also saw a lot of conversation about shortages on elastic, which elastic price has gone through the roof, according to the people who actually know what that stuff should cost. and so, you know, like there's price gouging or there was going on. Now I think the price is just higher on this stuff. And so, you know, I just could kind of see, all right, we need a mask with ties. And so we started doing ties from Jersey, which is like a t-shirt material. Mm-hmm. And that we did those and we are doing elastic because I found a supplier, a woman on Facebook Marketplace that owns, funny enough, a shop that she imports handcrafted goods from her family in Mexico. And so she sold me a bunch of elastic cheaper than I could find it anywhere. And most places were like, yeah, I've ordered it, but it's not coming, like the quilt shops and things around wow. town. And so people had it, but like the whole country is making masks. So it will create a shortage. And so this woman that sold me over Facebook Marketplace, I actually offered to help her with her Shopify site because it was such a big deal to me that she was going to sell me 13 rolls of 104 yards each of this elastic so I could get it to people. So I subsequently have been selling it to Alley Cat's Quilt Shop and one of my main makers just at cost because I don't want them to have to incur more. And then I actually sold some to Ben Franklin yesterday because she ran out. So it's actually in my pickup spot. She's probably going to get it today because their suppliers aren't getting it to them very quickly. And so, yeah, our masks, we have, we're having people tie the elastic a bit long so that if it's got the flat elastic, they can untie and retie it. So it can get a little shorter or a little longer to allow some adjustability. We also have elastic loops, which funny enough, I don't remember who, I don't think I knew them. You can see that, but someone sent me a case of these, like 1,000 of them, a stranger, when I first started this. And so they sent the invoice and where it came from. And so I ordered more of those and we're supplying those on our website and also gave that to the local quilt shop. So they have the elastic loops, which are a little easier to deal with. Those become adjustable because you can untie them. And so I wanted to make these more functional. And the big thing that we did is we made the sewing pattern so the nose piece can come out and be replaced. Not every single mask we put out has had that, but the listing should say if it was replaceable or not. And so that to me is important because that part will wear out if these are being worn for a really long time. And I don't think it's great to create a bunch more garbage. And so with the right filter in there, this is probably going to be a better choice. I won't say than an N95, but then say a dust mask or something of, you know, the ones that are approved are always going to be better. But I think that this could be a really great alternative.
That's awesome. And another example of people just helping people. You know, this in times like this, it would be very easy to kind of take an advantageous approach to buying and selling and, you know, that type of thing. But it just really sounds like everybody's just trying to help each other out and just kind of do the right thing. And it just speaks to the community and it warms your heart.
Yeah. I started out with the masks on the sliding scale where they could get it for free, or they can pay as much as they want. And the sliding scale, you know, I had to move it so there was a base price because there was people all over the country just ordering, and it was just a little bit too easy to get it for free. But in the beginning, I really thought they should be out there that way because there's a lot of free ones, but the groups were really servicing the healthcare field, and they had just locally had gotten to like what the hospital was requesting. And then I started putting them out there because I didn't want to diminish that effort at all. And I didn't want to look like I was trying to money grab on this thing. And so I put them out there in a sliding scale while they were free for like, I think a week. And I don't know how many we gave away that week, that it was probably quite a few, but you know, I even had a woman message me. She said, this was really sad, but she messaged and she said, oh, I'm on Social Security. I just spent four of my last $7 on the shipping for the mask. And I was just mortified. So I refunded her that, you know, like money doesn't mean much when you're like, that person has nothing, you know, and they're buying a mask right now, or at least the shipping. And so with that sliding scale, other people chose to pay more. And what's kind of the beautiful thing about it is my goal is to break even. I've never had that goal. Jewelry is profitable. I have a good margin. Like that's okay. Jewelry is not something people need, and not something they need now, regardless of their income. And so, the sliding scale is kind of like a leap of faith, right? I do the math each week and make sure that we're covering the cost of it. Sometimes I think it's dipping below, and other times it might be going above. But my real goal is to break even on that, because I think that there's people on both ends of that spectrum that need them for cheaper, and people who want to support it. And the business side of me knows these people, if I support them and protect them, they're going to buy my jewelry. And that's not why I did it, but I know that they will, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Do you know any rough idea about how many masks you guys have made?
Oh, what we've made is probably a lot. I think we have a good inventory right now. So we probably should have people sharing stuff online and getting them out there, but we've sold several thousand. I think it's creeping up. I thought it was 4,000, but I looked at the data again, it's like 3, but there was a lot of them we gave for free that didn't make it through our software either. And so the making, I think it's probably, about 5,000 masks or so over like since the middle of April. So it's quite a few. Yeah. And we've had businesses buy from us. We had, I don't think they'd mind if I say, but AmCab bought from us, you know, and they help people with furnaces and Meals on Wheels. When I first bought my home, it was not a nice home, and they helped us with a furnace because I didn't have money. And so to kind of have that turnaround and have it available for them, there was a lot available for free, but people can only work so fast. And if someone has a budget and just needs them now, I was aiming to get them out. We couldn't give them in bulk for free, but I tried my best to give them the best price we could, you know?
Sure. So if somebody wants to buy a mask from you or get their hands on these, how do they make that happen? I guess, where can they go to make that purchase?
Our website is BethMilner.com, and Milner is with two L's and an N, so like Miller with an N. That's my cat meowing in the background here. It always makes it more fun when you get a big meow.
Yeah, absolutely. My dog's outside the door probably waiting to come in as soon as I open it. So
yeah, it's funny how they're just waiting, you know? So they can go to the website to purchase the masks from us. I've contacted 3 other local businesses that I'm suggesting they should sell our masks and offering them bulk quantities, because I think that with the power of some of these bigger places that have people working, or they supply workwear for contractors and things like that, I think it would be really smart if they go local. And I guess the other part that's really, you know, near and dear to my heart, so people can buy them from us online. If they need to, they can call. Sometimes it's a little hard when we get a lot of phone calls, but we can definitely get back to people. But I think that the important piece of this to me is the local bit. So we're buying all of our fabric from local quilt shops for the most part, everything I've bought. And we got our elastic from a woman down in Grand Rapids. And this cat, he just has to come up. we're paying local people to do the work. So this payroll protection grant loan thing, it just occurred to me yesterday after weeks of doing this that the perfect use of it is manufacturing. Because most of the people who got this have to, like say a retail business has to buy their goods. And it doesn't cover cost of goods sold. It covers payroll and some rent. I'm using all of mine on payroll. But for me, since I can pay people to make the product, it occurred to me that's going to benefit me greatly, that we know how to make things. I hired a whole family to make. Mom's a fiber artist and dad's a veteran and their kids are in their 20s and, you know, they're all learning to sew. I think they're going to drop off like 300 masks today and I'm going to have way more masks than I've had yet. I was barely keeping 50 in stock and now we're probably going to creep on 1,000 today. And so I'm going to work really hard next week to just get them out there.
you joked a little bit earlier about, getting into the sewing game, I guess you could say. Do you foresee possibly like when we kind of come out of all of this COVID craziness, maybe adding that as part of the business to like your repertoire at all?
I do actually, because I hired a friend who's a fourth generation seamstress and she's so talented. Today we put out a beard mask. So for people who have a longer beard,
all right.
You don't probably have a long enough one that'll matter too much, but like someone with like a beard down to their, you know, really big beard can stuff it in the pocket for the mask. And we're thinking about, you know, the restaurant workers are going back to work. A lot of those guys might have a beard, you know, and the mask doesn't actually cover. And then you're just breathing stuff right through your beard instead of actually covering. And so with this beard mask is really, really kind of cool. But we've been talking about what's next. And I started thinking, you know, maybe hats, because a milliner is a hat maker. Mm-hmm. That's the term for a hat maker.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Most people don't. It's milliner, I guess, but I think that's where my name came from. And okay. So maybe hats. I was also trying to think about what do people wear a lot of and maybe can never find the nicest type of thing. And I thought underwear, boxers. I mean, you know, like we can make higher quality things. I don't know if we'll do that, but I've had lots of ideas. And then I don't know if it's true or if they're going to enforce it, but I heard that if they may require massage therapists to wear full PPE to go back to work, which would be like isolation gowns, which sounds really, really dramatic, but it's just a gown that you can pull off and the cuffs like stay on your wrist. So it goes inside out. And I thought, well, we're thinking about convertible isolation gowns that like when you turn it around, it's just a nice overshirt with a little tie and it could be reversible and maybe the cuff comes back off of it or something by taking a stitching out. And so I don't know if we'll do that, but if they require that of massage therapists, I think at least we could offer them something that could become part of their new wardrobe after this is over, if they have to change between each client. So we're just trying to keep our finger on the pulse of what's going on. And I don't think massage therapists are going to want a bunch of disposable plasticky shirts if they could have a cotton thing instead, you know?
I love that you're like racking your brain and just kind of throwing stuff at the wall to kind of see what sticks. Do you think, that because you're very artistic, does that lend to that creativity and that thought process? Probably. I would assume that goes hand in hand.
Yeah, it definitely does. I mean, and then, you know, the mask thing was just obvious. Like they were saying everybody, first they said masks don't do much. At least I heard that maybe on social media. Maybe I wasn't super careful on the news. And then they said the mask only protects others from you. And that was sort of put out there. And then they said the mask actually protects both. And I was like, they're going to require everybody to wear a mask. And I started doing this before they required it. And then the day I started putting them online, the CDC put out a pattern for a cloth mask. And so it was just sort of obvious to me that if the whole country were volunteering to make masks, then there's going to be a whole lot of people who don't know how to get their hands on those that could more easily buy one. So I knew that there's people like my mom who aren't great at online shopping that needed to hear about it. So I've been kind of getting on the news about it a bit. And I actually had a lady call me from Munising who is legally blind, and she called me to order masks. And she has her credit card number memorized, and I was able to ship her masks because she couldn't see how to order them on the website. She could kind of tell that they were on the website, but like, wow. You know, and so there's people all over that don't have the same access in the UP. They don't have internet. And those people called us all day the day after I was on TV with this because, you know, they need a mask too. They might have a doctor's appointment. They might be elderly, you know, like, so yeah, I kind of have a big heart thinking about all of the people, you know, and it's not just one of us or one group of us. We're all in it together. And first we have to help the healthcare field. And I'm really glad the volunteers did that because they're taking care of us, but then it's everybody else, you know? The food co-op bought tons of masks for me. They actually bought 100 the first day that they had bought more previous for the employees, but the first day it was required that businesses have people wear masks. They bought 100 and gave them out at the door to customers. Yeah.
It's incredible. Absolutely incredible. We've pretty much checked off every box that I had of things I really wanted to kind of touch on. Is there anything that you feel like I kind of missed or anything else that you want to kind of put out there?
I think overall, like, recognizing the economics of what it means to spend and buy local is important, you know, that should be more obvious during this pandemic than ever. I remember joking with the food co-op and I was like, I'm faster than Amazon. And there were no masks available when I was first starting to sell them. And so, you know, we need to really refocus our energies on supporting local and downtown. I have a lot of friends who own restaurants and businesses, and it, you know, there are the big retailers and the big box stores, but I who's the owner and where's their dollars going? And for me, it's really important that we support the people downtown and keep those dollars flowing locally into our community, because they'll come right back around again and we'll be better off because of it. And so I really think anybody who maybe just finds it easier to order on Amazon, well, now they can just order from a downtown store because they're mostly all selling stuff online and you can just go pick it up and it isn't overnight. It's like right then.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. In fact, Amazon's been way backed up. If you try to order anything, it's been taking way longer to get stuff. So, I mean, and not just the speed of getting something, obviously that shouldn't be your only reason to purchase something. But like you said, who's the owner? Where are those dollars really going? And, you know, you can have a big impact that reverberates through the entire community. I couldn't agree with you more on what you just said.
Yeah, when I used to sell my jewelry at music festivals, you'd basically be in a little mini economy for the weekend, right? And so I would think about that whole sense of local economy, because if I go buy from the food vendor goes to buy from that artist buys from me, and then I go buy some more food. And that's an easier way to imagine what it means to spend locally, because you're not siphoning out these dollars. You're actually passing the same dollars around and your economic stability becomes stronger. And so, you know, we are selling mask supplies too, which some of them I have purchased from outside of the area, but if people need elastic, they can get on my website. And in 2 hours, we have like a pickup time from 12 to 5. So if they call within that range and we're still open, like, they can get elastic for the masks they're making too. And so I thought it was important to build up the folks making masks. We have a free pattern on the blog. So we've got that, available. We have the nose pieces for sale. I have some mask kits, so if people don't even have fabric, they can get the whole kit if they've got a sewing machine or if they want to hand sew one. So we're trying to kind of hit all the different people that might need these.
Awesome. Well, to wrap things up here, I guess I'll ask one final question, which is the same question that I ask everybody at the end of each podcast episode, and that's, how do you like your pasty?
Ketchup.
I'm guilty. That's okay. I get all sorts of answers, and ketchup is more than acceptable. I think that's probably the kind of standard issue answer. So
I'm sure the gravy tastes good, but I just, you know, the ketchup.
Well, Beth, I can't thank you enough for not only coming on the podcast, but just for being a beacon of hope and a really great story in our community. If we had, you know, more people like you, I think we'd be in a lot better place. So thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. And I'd like to say, I bet there's a lot of people like me. People just know my name. And so I get calls, but I think everybody's doing this in a small way. And that's what the UP is about, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you again. Like I said, I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate the interview.
And that's going to wrap things up for this week's episode. Another huge thank you to Beth, not only for sitting down to chat with me, but just for being a good person. And it seems kind of silly to have to say that, but you know, you just see so much craziness out there in the world right now, and I'll be honest, I just get so frustrated with some of it. So to just be able to talk to somebody that's just kind and decent and doing the right thing and helping out her community and also keeping her business going and keeping her employees working, and like I said, just doing the right thing, it's just a breath of fresh air. So thank you, Beth. Keep fighting the good fight. And you know, as I always say to you guys, I want to hear your big takeaways from the podcast, so don't hesitate to reach out to me. You can shoot me an email at chatitupod@gmail.com. Otherwise, you can find me on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. Just type in Chat It Up Podcast and you should be able to track me down. Also, as always, wherever you're listening in, please subscribe, rate, leave me a review. That's how the podcast gets more visibility, and that's how this grows. So thank you all so very much for tuning in. I hope you all have a happy and a healthy Memorial Day weekend here. So as always, I'm your host, Shooter, reminding you to keep your chin up and your eyes forward.